commitment in a lease to apply against the land rental. That's another idea. I haven't had time to think about it very much. Anyhow, basically the credit system's a subsidy. Mr. Chairman, do you want a break now or something?
No, I just stand up from time to time, sit for hours.
Yeah, you have to do the windows all open.
Kind of cool you off a little.
I'll try to go on at a more rapid pace, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm afraid to take a break because historically when they take a break for 10 minutes, nobody comes back for an hour. We've already had a lot of coffee for lunch.
Let them take a break one at a time.
Yeah, that's kind of the way we're
going. We'll have a written pass.
Punish those that do it.
Anyway, why don't we, I think we can go ahead. We're still on H, I think, right?
I think we pretty well covered H, Jim, unless there's further questions on it.
Well, I just want to address that question in section I of the inconsistency there with the notion of royalty bidding.
Okay, well, I was going to do that next.
Okay.
Okay, coming down to section I. This is, to some extent, a repeat of language that occurs in the present statutes. If you're going to have a royalty share reserved to the state or to the landowner, you might encounter a situation near the end of the life of an oil field that the operator can no longer afford to operate that field. In other words, he may not, presumably, could reach a point where he isn't even meeting expenses anymore. But sooner than that, he's going to reach a point where he can find a better place to put his money and his people. So there is a necessity, if you want to continue production to recover the oil, to consider the economic effect of a royalty share. Our present statutes provide that that royalty share can be reduced if it's necessary to prolong the life of the field. Language is repeated here. It's got some caveats attached to it, but there's some problems with those too. The protection is that the commissioner may not grant a reduction of royalty until 2 years initial production has occurred. So there is some history of production and some history of costs. In each lessee requesting the reduction is made a clear showing that the revenue is insufficient to produce a reasonable rate of return with respect to that lessee's total investment in the field. Now, what that would mean is that somebody has to come in and basically lay their books on the table, bare their souls to get a royalty reduction. Now, whether they really have to do that or not, I don't know. Suppose you had a royalty bid and was bid at a higher rate, let's say 50%. And suppose that after a couple of years production, the lessees come in and say, look, we're going to have to reduce this to 20% or else we're going to have to shut down the field. And the commissioner says, well, the information you're submitting is not sufficient. And they say, well, we're going to abandon the field. What sort of a political situation does that create in the state if it's an important producing oil field in Alaska? I'd leave that to the committee to speculate on, but I think it'd be one hell of a hot potato. But you still have to have a provision for reducing royalty unless you're going to leave that oil in the ground. What it does, though, in effect, is this. It's a serious problem with respect to high rates of royalty. I don't think it's serious with respect to low rates of royalty, like 12% or something like that. But reading the last three lines of that section, 25, 26, 27, is insufficient to produce a reasonable rate of return to that lessee's total investment in the field. What that that means, if you look at it another way, is that although the operator may be able to make what might be normally regarded as a dandy return from the production at current royalty rates, he also has a guarantee that if he's willing to put more money, more investment into the field to that he can get a reasonable rate of return on that investment out of the state's royalty share on application to the commissioner. I don't know if that's a, you know, if that's a situation that people want to be facing, that they're going to guarantee people that simply because they've unilaterally made a decision to increase their level of investment, that they're going to be able to take that out of the state's royalty share. It underscores a weakness with the royalty bidding system. Now, the reason royalty bidding was kept in over some of the reservations that were expressed by people on the committee, including me, is that it has been very strongly supported by the administration. And I'm not really here to defend the royalty bidding procedure. I don't think that it's one we should adopt, frankly. But if the department really thinks they can make it work, maybe it's an idea, maybe it's worthwhile to give them the chance. But it does bring up serious problems. It can encourage somebody to overbid on a royalty, taking the bid away from someone that might have had a better bid, more responsible bid, with the knowledge that they're going to be able to get a reduction in that royalty rate. And I don't know how you get around that problem when royalty bidding. I really don't. I don't think there is any way around it. I think you're open to the complications there. They might, probably an operator, like a major company did this, they aren't going to do it more than once, because the next time the commissioner is going to say, you know, no, we're not going to accept this bid because in the past you've shown that you're irresponsible. So I think people would be pretty careful about it, but whether it's good public policy to leave that sort of barn door open or not, I'll leave for the Department of Natural Resources to argue.
I would imagine the problem wouldn't come from a major producer anyway. It probably comes from somebody that came out to left field.
I think you're right about that, and I think the same thing would happen if some paper corporation got a bid on this basis and wasn't able to perform, got the royalty rate reduced. That'd be the last time that the state administration accepted a bid from that sort of a combine on a royalty basis. But I don't think it's necessary to accomplish the other purposes and the main purposes of the legislation, frankly. The encouragement of economic investments in the state.
Well, Mr. Schwartz,
at what point on the decline of the field would that take place? 50% from peak to zero?
Well, it depends probably on how high the royalty bid rate was.
Well, somebody just take our normal 12%, 12.5%.
Oh, you're talking about 12.5%?
Right.
That's fairly small royalty share, so that would be, you know, right at the tail end of production. You can talk about reducing that after most of the oil had been produced from the field.
And then let's take a case where we might have a 25% royalty. Where would it, where from the peak to the bottom? Would 50% of the decline, is that where you're 25% royalty would start dropping off?
Well, I don't think there's any way to answer that question, Red, except to say that the higher the royalty rate, the sooner that somebody's going to say that that it needs to be reduced. The lower it is, the later they are. The reason that you can't answer the question is it depends on the economics of the field itself, the transportation costs, the operating costs. Depends on other things, of course, too, the price of the oil and the taxes, all the operating costs that you run into, and how the operator nets out.
Then if we have a high-cost field that you just described, then anywhere after the peak down could start dropping the royalty share off.
Right. Well, okay, that's right. I think it's fair to assume in Alaska, basically, that's what you're dealing with, high-cost fields.
Okay.
Any place that's...
Then from the peak of the production of the field, when it starts to decline, you can start dropping off your royalty, and it could drop right off now.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. Right. I think that that's a time when a producer would start looking for a reduction. As soon as there was a decline, they start looking for a reduction in the royalty.
What is there a bottom now on the decline of the royalty from 25 down to 12, and it'll never fall below 12.5%?
No. Under present law, we have a minimum 12.5% royalty. That royalty can be reduced. The commissioner can reduce that royalty rate if it's necessary to prolong the life of the field. It's in current law. The reason it doesn't turn out to be a big problem is that, you know, the current royalty rates are, well, they're all 1/8 right now. That's a fairly small amount. So the taking out that gross share and keeping it for the state doesn't have a major impact on the production until you get toward the final stages of production. Until you're going to probably in the stage where you're going to secondary, tertiary recovery methods, maybe, but it's going to depend on the economics of a particular field. The only thing I'm saying is this. Somebody bids a very high royalty rate. They've got a damn strong incentive to come in and ask for it to be reduced once this initial 2-year period's gone by. And they'll probably keep hammering on the commissioner until they get some break. I would if I thought it was going to do me any good.
Okay. Since we don't tax our royalty share now, what is it clear in present law if the commissioner were to reduce the royalty amount that would be subject to the severance tax? The additional production is part of the leasee's share, and would it be under this proposal?
Yeah, I think that is clear. The severance tax applies to the lessee's share of the oil. And if the state agrees to change that, then the amount of, or the percentage of the oil that's subject to severance tax changes at the same time in the same amount. There's no question on that.
Then, may I?
Which one?
Then, if he has overbid,
mm-hmm.
he can immediately start asking for a reduction in the royalty share.
Well, not immediately. 2 years would have to expire.
Well, that's only 2 years in the production of the field, is that right?
Right. Yeah, 2 years of production would have to expire.
That's not much of a field if it doesn't have any more than... that wouldn't be much of a field if it's if you were to start from the decline in the production of the field within 2 years. That sure wouldn't be much of a field to start with.
No, it wouldn't be. But what I'm saying is that suppose you had a very high royalty bid, and this 2-year period goes by, and the operator comes in and says, look, my costs are very high and so forth, and I've got this level of investment, and I need some sort of a break. The commissioner's in a tough spot, and I think it's a weakness. You know, the fact that you have to provide some abatement of royalty, it just makes economic sense to do it. means that you got a major weakness in any royalty bidding system.
Then
that's the weakness.
Then maybe you're telling me that under a conservation measure we only allow so much, and his guesstimate was wrong, and he finds it out just within 2 years, regardless of how good a field is under there. If he's restricted under the conservation measures that we might impose on him.
Well, that's another possibility, there, yes.
Well, that I tie that with what you're talking about.
It would have a direct effect on you, right?
Okay.
I don't know. Did I cover the questions you were talking about in that, Mr. Chairman, or did you have other ones?
No, I did. I want to cover the reason why the original provision allowing the commissioner to withhold certain acreage from the lease.
Oh, why that was.
Yeah. That's in somewhere, I guess, would have come in.
There should be a letter along with this bill from House Resources on that subject. The reason is this, is that Under present law, there's no specific provision in the statute that the commissioner can withhold certain acreage. He just decides to sell certain acreage, and what he doesn't sell is what's withheld. We didn't intend by having that in the bill in the first place to change the present system, and since it was becoming a point of controversy, it was just withdrawn from the bill. And there's a letter of committee intent floating around someplace. It should be here, but
I see it.
It says that we're not
do it anyhow.
We're not changing the commissioner's authority to decide not to lease certain acreage, but we're just taking it out of the bill because people are starting to. What was happening? People were running in all directions and jumping about and saying this means checkerboarding and things like that. And that's not what it meant. It just meant that the current authority would still be there. So we just decided to take that point of contention out of the bill.
It would be checkerboarding if it was there.
Well, I don't think so, but
don't get me wrong,
on the grounds you're right, we took it out.
I always have been for checkerboarding.
Okay, well,
starting in 1971.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Well, going on here, you got a provision in J that portions of the cash bonus bid at the time of the lease sale can be deferred. In other words, the cash bonus can be paid out on the installment plan. Presumably, the person is going to have to put up some sort of security or bond that they're actually going to be able to do that, or else they're going to have to put up the money at the very front. But the idea, again, is to encourage competition. It's not the idea that somebody gets 3 years into the development of a lease and decides to walk away from the last 2 years of payment. It's just it's a proposal that eliminates or tries to eliminate the heavy front end loading for the cash bonus bid. I don't think it's terribly important to the bill, but it's something that you might want to keep in there.
Again, Mr. Chairman, yeah. Wouldn't that be controlled by the conservation measures? So that you couldn't, even in the first years of your production, you could not, what I would say, overproduce the well.
Well, no, on section, are you talking about section I?
Yes.
Rather.
Yeah. I'm just referring to your immediate conversation.
No, I was talking about section J, page 5, running on to page 6.
Yeah.
Okay, that just provides that cash bonus bids can be paid on the installment plan for the reasons I previously mentioned. Going on to K, this is put into the bill to make sure says that all the terms and regulations necessary for reasonable understanding and valuation of a particular bidding method before the public announcement of the terms of the proposed sale employing that method, so that everybody's going to be reading off the same sheet of music when they're figuring out their bid. They know what the rules are. And I think presumably the commissioner would do this anyway, but because we are talking about new and I suppose some people strange bidding mechanisms, that we thought that we ought to make very sure that the terms are clear before the sale is announced. Section L provides for a storage of the state's royalty share, and there's some debate in committee as to whether or not to keep that in. There are similar provisions, although not identical in current law. Section M is a significant section of the bill.
Mr. Speaker, I ask on section L that. Is there a provision present law for trading? I guess that would just be a matter of negotiation, and it's probably allowed, I think. is that to be continued in this royalty? You could swap, if you had a royal, the state royalty share for another production in another field, or agree to...
Well, Mr. Chairman, what it says here is that the commissioner may enter into an agreement.
Well, it does more than storage.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming down, but it says, in both sections, it says the commissioner may enter into an agreement. I don't think the second authority is particularly clear in the current law. In fact, I'm not sure it exists. The commissioner may have the authority anyway. He may not. He's got authority for the first section of L, to some extent, the present law.
But the second half is not clear, and this would provide for any lease containing that provision.
Well, he can enter, it provides for the commissioner with the consent of the lessee to enter into an agreement. And so what you have is an agreement where both parties are going to have to agree. It makes clear the commissioner has the authority to enter into that type of agreement. There's some policy questions in that. There may be some conflict with the way this is written and provisions in House Bill 815, which at the work session I think we can probably resolve. I don't think Section L is an absolutely significant section retaining the bill.
Well, is there a situation in which you'd want to give the commissioner authority to require as a conditional lease that well swaps be allowed between fields, even unforeseen ones? I mean, this contemplates one that somebody has in mind.
Well, I can think of situations where you want to do that, but you want to give them the authority to mandate something like that. The problem is that you're affecting more than just the state's interests there. That's why it's written in permissive terms and requires an agreement.
But this, I think this is talking about an agreement, is it not, after the leasing arrangement?
Right.
And I'm talking about one prior. I suppose he has authority now to do that in the leasing. Does he?
Well, he's got part of this authority. Whether or not he's got all of it under the current law, I don't know. Commissioner's got a lot of authority under the current law, in some ways more than he has under this bill. But it's not always explicit.
Do you think that's a worthwhile provision to have, is to allow the commissioner to consider anyway, clearly be able to consider mandatory swap where you have at least you weren't taking any valuable property from DC.
Yeah, well, the same thought occurred to me, Representative Green. What it came down to is this, to be honest about it. I thought that the bill was probably complicated enough and controversial, as a matter of fact, enough without including that provision in the bill. I would like the state to have the ability within some agency to require trades of production, also for gas, because I think that a lot of times it simply makes sense, and I can point to some specific cases where I think it would have made sense. But rather than getting into the discussion of the transportation questions and some of the other things that enter into it, nothing like that appears in the bill so far.
Well, that could be an item that you could consider before entering the lease, but it would allow the producer, of course, would get the same amount of profit, but there might be a transportation cost save. That's the only, you'd have to write it in such a way the producer wouldn't lose anything by it, except to extend he participated maybe in a transportation system. That's it. That's my only thinking on that. I'm way behind you on that because I haven't heard any discussion.
Just once.
Yeah. Under the provision then, lines 8 through about 11, the commissioner in the Prudhoe Bay field right now could enter into an agreement with the producers up there and say, we don't want to take the state's royalty gas. And if the life of that field is 15 years, they could just leave that gas in the field for the next 15 years, couldn't they?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in trying to answer the question, Red, you've got to go back to something I said earlier. I think that there's some possible conflicts here between Section L and the current conservation statutes and the proposed revisions in House Bill 815. Your statement might be correct, and that's a possibility. What I'm really saying about Section L is I think it needs to be reviewed in the light of the suggested changes in 815 and probably revised on that basis.
I do have one more question here. A little conflict in my mind. Actually, the commissioner could hold back a certain amount of gas and trade it with a lessee that's not involved in this field and involved with another production field, so long as the type and the amount and the kind and quality of oil or gas would be the same. Actually, he could do that in two different fields if it was the same lessee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, he could.
That's
a broad interpretation of language.
Field two, we take fields one and two, and if that first number one field was 50% produced, not quite, but half of the life of the field, they could trade that gas off and make the trade in field number two and pick it up half the life of the next field, and we wouldn't get any gas if the two fields are 15-year fields. You wouldn't get any gas production for 30 years.
You also might not, depending on how things happen, might not need any production at all. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's why I think there's a conflict between this and the conservation statutes and the proposed revisions. But going on to Section M, it's a substantial section of the bill. The basic thing that it does is set a lease period for a lease term of 5 years with the possibility of granting a term greater than 5 years but not to exceed 10 years if a longer period is necessary, and provides conditions under which the oil and gas lease can be automatically extended. But the guts of it are really two things. One is the reduction of the term of the lease to 5 years, and there's a change in the there's a change in the acreage, the lease tract. The most significant change, though, is the 5 years, and the idea is to encourage people to do something with the leases that they have and not get 10-year leases and speculate on them. I think there'll be a substantial amount of testimony to the committee from industry in opposition to the 5-year lease term, on the grounds that it takes a long time to develop a lease in Alaska, that your seasonal variations in the conditions of remoteness and difficult terrain, environmental considerations often require, at least in their judgment, more than 5 years to examine a property. I'd only say that it's in the state's interest to provide a reasonable period of time, but not too long for somebody to do something with the property. The section as written provides that where a longer period is necessary to encourage exploration development, where environmental conditions restrict operations, a lease can be granted for 10 years. It's a very significant change in the law, the term of the lease.
Would that, let me see, Would you not cover that with a minimum work commitment provision?
Mr. Chairman, you might be able to do that with a minimum work commitment provision. If there were some sort of time limit specified in the minimum work commitment provision. If not, then a person can say, well, I'm going to do it next year, next year, next year, next year. And I don't think human nature is any different inside an oil company than it is every place else. I've observed it. People have a habit of, not necessarily sometimes doing things before they have to. And it might be in the state's interest to have people do something with the lease with the acreage that is under lease. I think it is. That's the reason for the change in the term. But it's probably one of the most controversial sections of the bill in its present form.
You mean the time element?
Right, time element.
You know, if I might, Mr. Chair, just once, given any 5-year period on the lease anywhere north of Fairbanks, I can't imagine any company that's a competent company that couldn't move all of his equipment, including the total drill rig, set up the pad, move everything into it, in anywhere in northern Alaska in less than a 2-year period. Now, you may not be able to drill it. You might lose a tool or something like that. You might lose a year there, but I can't imagine. It isn't like it was in 65 and 55 to get across there. My guy, you can go anywhere now in the area that we're working, and with the type of equipment we've got nowadays in the wintertime with lakes and rivers to land on, but any kind of a herd. It seems unreasonable to me that anything more than 5 years, unless it was some particular. I don't know where you'd go. I don't know where you'd go in Alaska that you couldn't start from scratch and drill a hole, an oil well, in less than 2 years.
Let's speak.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm responding. I think that you're right that it can be done. It's humanly possible to do that. The arguments that have been raised against the short lease period, lease term, run something like this, that to begin with, until the bids are evaluated, the company doesn't know whether or not they've got the bid. So they're really starting zero on day one. Okay, then after that, they have to incorporate that acreage in their exploration program, and that they have limited resources to commit to that exploration program. They have other leases which they've also taken. There's a limitation on the, if not on the money, at least on the personnel and equipment that's available for, say, drilling, that there are sometimes rather restrictive environmental safeguards provided that sometimes they only have a very short season, depending on where it is in the state, to work, because they have to work during the winter season. Or in other cases, they have to put together a package among a number of lessees in order to develop a drilling program in an area where it's going to be very high cost, such as up offshore, and that they just run into these things, and they probably would get around to beginning to drill the lease in the fourth or fifth year of the lease, and they don't think that 5 years is enough. Those are the arguments against it. The arguments, as you see, did not persuade the Resources Committee that the lease term should be extended beyond 5 years unless there was a reason to do so. And there's language in the bill that provides it. They weren't persuasive to the Resources Committee. But those are the arguments that you'll hear. And I'm sure in some cases they have merit. Generally, though, I think it's in the state's interest to have people do something with the property.
Within 5 years?
Within a reasonable period of time, yes. and not just simply hold it in inventory as it were, you know, in sort of a speculative situation. If somebody's going to speculate with state lands, it probably ought to be the state. And I don't propose that the state do that either. Anyhow, that's going to be a point of major contention in the bill. In fact, some companies have argued so strongly for the longer lease term, they said it in resources that, you know, they're willing to swallow even a rapidly escalating acreage rental as long as they have the guarantee that they've got the longer lease term. And the committee did consider extending it maybe to 6 years instead of five on the grounds that that was some sort of a compromise, but finally decided that the case hadn't been proven that it absolutely should be longer than that. And I think the administration will comment pretty much along the same lines, except more strongly than I remarked.
Mr. Speaker, what I would suppose that the tenor of the industry's remarks is sort of that they kind of have to look down the line and tie up as much as they can for the future. I gather that's probably where it was, so I didn't hear any of it. What was the gist of those remarks?
Well, I feel very uncomfortable, Mr. Chairman, trying to speak for the oil companies. But just my impression of the arguments was that, to begin with, a company can't begin to make any decisions on developing the property, exploring the property, until after they've got the lease. Okay. So that, you know, that might not be true in all cases. In some cases, they might have everything set up and ready to go as soon as they get the lease. They're going to be on the property right away. But, and so then they have other property under lease too, and then they've got an overall program for evaluating this property, and that there are difficulties both in raising the money for exploration, which, you know, the company itself has to pay for. That's those exploration costs are sunk costs, unlike the investments in a proven field. So it's got to come out of their own earnings. So there's limited amount of money available to apply to a leasing program, to an exploration program. That the same thing is true of personnel and equipment, and that it's going to take them a while to schedule the property. And it's going to, just on an administrative basis, and it's going to also take them some time to comply with the environmental conditions. So that they're going to be in, they're going to be in maybe in the fourth or fifth year to prove up the property. And if they miss it, or if they don't have a, you know, any producing well on the property, they've lost their lease in spite of the fact they might have paid, say, $100 million in bonus bid to get that lease. So those are generally the tenor of the arguments, I think. And I'm sure that there's people here in the room who would be glad to elaborate on that. Anyhow, going on, we've got, I don't want to take up the committee's whole afternoon. I thought perhaps we'd go over this more rapidly than we have so far. But going on, we have the rental payments for the property in Section N, setting out a schedule, which is an escalating rental schedule. Coming to section, going on to page 8, section P of the bill, you've got authority that's given to the commissioner to basically, what it comes down to is change the terms of the lease for the purposes of conservation and the purposes of developing a unit agreement on a property or on a group of properties. And again, there might be some conflict, see, here between this section of the bill, Title 31 and the proposed revisions to the conservation statutes. But basically, it allows them to change the terms of leases, which may be different leases under agreements, to protect all parties and interests and develop a production plan for the property. That's the purpose of Section P. And Section Q, similar, see language at the end of it, top of page 9, the provisions concerning cooperative or unit plans are in addition to and do not affect Title 31. I'm not sure that they don't affect Title 31. I think that's something the committee should consider in the work session. We're not going into the technicalities right now. Section R provides that producing acreage is not to be counted against limitations on the acreage that under lease. Let's see, I think sections S and T probably don't need a great deal of discussion. Section U again may be in conflict with the limitations on overlifting and underlifting that appear in House Bill 815. And it might be better to leave some of these questions up to the conservation Oil and Gas Conservation Committee or Commission if one is established. Section B is basically covers the local hire provision. Section W is on page 10 during line 14 is a highly controversial section of the bill. It's recommended not to be kept in by the consultants that testified before the committee. The department strongly supports the retention of the non-competitive leasing system or provision for non-competitive leasing. It would set out a procedure that if land's offered for lease and it received no bids at a competitive sale, it may be immediately offered by lease on terms appearing most advantageous to the commissioner, including leasing non-competitively. And that at a minimum there will be a 12.5% royalty. There can be a sliding scale royalty, and that basically the provides a mechanism for non-competitive leasing of state lands either over the counter or on a negotiated basis. And the arguments that the department makes run something like this: that this is not an important part of the state's leasing program, that the commissioner ought to have the flexibility to dispose of lands in which there isn't much interest to someone that thinks that they can do something about them, even though they're not willing to bid on them competitively, and to negotiate a lease that protects the state interest in the case something is developed on those lands, and that in any event it's going to be a minuscule part of the state's leasing program and going to be handled that way. The arguments against it basically are that I think recounted pretty well by Mr. Lipton this morning. Commissioner could hold a lease sale with minimum bid terms or conditions in the for the lease that nobody's going to bid on, even if the property's maybe a fairly good prospect, then turn around and negotiate a lease with somebody. And it might not be in the state's interest to do that. It's a big barn door in the competitive, in the whole idea of a leasing program that's based on a competitive system existing within a free market. And to the extent that that barn door is used, maybe against the state's interest. There are people in the state in the business of buying and selling non-competitive leases. And of course, they're very insistent on keeping a provision for non-competitive leasing in the law. There is one at present. What we did basically is take the department at their word and resources that this was not going to be an important part of the leasing program, and that we'd leave it alone on that basis. I don't know whether that's good judgment or not. I have strong reservations about it. I guess the best guide is what's happened in the past. Have there been abuses? Well, I don't think there's any. There's such serious abuse that it's, the argument to take it out is compelling. But
what we're really talking about, I guess, is not yanking the rug out from under those few people that are in that business.
Politically, that's.
That's probably what we're talking
hitting
about.
The nail on
I
the
can
head.
See how a person believe that the state's best interests lay in just unloading the leases as quickly as possible, let the people make the fortune.
I love to. How can I get down and do it?
Speed things up.
Yeah, sure.
You leave the windows open.
I think this section's going to need some work. I have to say that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we examined all sorts of ideas, such as the commissioner having to make a finding before he could do this, that you know, he's going to have to make a finding that that's the best thing to do and state the reasons publicly so that you know, some future commissioner wasn't working some sort of side deal for a company for which he formerly worked or something like that. And the more we got into it, to be honest about it, the whole thing turned look more and more like a can of worms. But we do have a non-competitive leasing provision at present, and politically, I guess if you take this out of the law, which, you know, economically and maybe from just general public policy standpoint, perhaps should be done. That's also going to raise a real pure, so, I don't know. If it's kept as a small part of the leasing program, it doesn't matter. But there's no guarantee there either.
How much of the acreage now leased? What proportion of the acreage now leased is leased non-competitively?
I think I've got the information here someplace, Clark. The department does have the information. I can get it for you. It's not in my head.
Maybe it would be approach would at least look into eliminating it to the same proportion, you know, cut it off, but you might want to put a limitation. I don't know if this acres per lease limitation doesn't mean much here, but it's lifted anyway. But we might want to have, in relation to the total acreage, some kind of limitation on that.
You might want to. There's all sorts of limitations it'd be good to put on this, to tell you the truth. But
well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, your remarks about looking at somebody that might be fast bucking some of this stuff. Our present commissioner is a real estate agent on the side, so I always look at all of this with a jaundiced eye.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before the committee takes that action, I would hope that they would get some sort of testimony from the department. Again, this is kept in the bill basically on the insistence of the department.
Well, the department does know that, you know, I'm sure they would operate fairly and honestly, but
they may not be here
next much. Anyway,
I'm sure Lucky won't be here.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think everybody understands that now.
I'm not sure. We just got our fingers crossed that he won't be here.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Baker.
Going on to section X, it's an interesting section in the bill. Basically, it's, I think it's pretty uniformly opposed by any large oil companies that are or have an interest in operating in the state of Alaska. It provides a provision that, it provides that the commissioner may adopt regulations in advance of a specific oil and gas lease sale to restrict joint bidding among major oil and gas companies. It wouldn't restrict a company from bidding, but it would, restrictions could be laid on how many companies could be bidding together, how many major companies could be bidding together. The idea is to promote competition. It was limited to a specific sale so that we didn't have blanket provisions that were going to apply statewide to every sale, and that commissioner basically then would have to make a decision on each sale.
What's a major oil and gas company?
Mr. Chairman? Only one time we had language in the bill that talked about multinational oil and gas companies and so forth. I guess what we'd have to do is, under the regulations, those would have to be defined. I presume it'd be companies with more than X amount of assets. I don't know.
So much but, in advertising.
Hmm? So anybody that can afford TV advertising, I guess. Mr. Chairman, the major, I think that one way to find out who the major companies are is ask questions and testimony on the bill as to who's opposed to it. But anyhow, it doesn't take a lot of discussion. It's a policy question. It either can be included in or included out. It's not vital to the purposes of the bill. It's just a mechanism to try to encourage as much competition as possible. Moving on to section Y on page 11. It's a provision that would give the state the right to purchase at least 1/6 of the oil and up to almost 1/2 of the volume of gas produced from a lease issued in accordance with this section at whatever the price was, fair market value or the regulated price. The companies that are interested in exploring and developing natural gas in particular don't like the high provision for 49% of the volume of gas. The reason it was put in the bill was that it has been a fairly consistent policy of the legislature and the state, I guess, to try to find in-state uses, encourage in-state development of oil and gas produced in the state. The section does make the right to purchase subject to the forecast in-state demand. It also gives the commissioner the right to waive the right to purchase on a particular sale. There's at least one other state that has a provision similar to this, New Mexico, where I think they have the right to purchase 100% of both the oil and gas production, but they never tried to exercise that right since that law went into effect, as near as we can find out.
Is this is 16 2/3% over and above the royalty, right?
No, it's not. The royalty share, whatever it is, would be credited against the amount that may be purchased. That's set out in it. Language there.
How about now the gas here? I guess there wouldn't really be any minimum requirement. I guess it's just whatever the commissioner thinks is necessary, up to 49%. I mean, in other words, if he would think that none would be necessary,
well, he could waive the right to buy. That's what he could do.
Well, it says up to 49%. That can be from zero on up.
Right, up to 49% would be zero on up.
So it's not really required to buy it.
No, it's a right to buy it. People argue, particularly on the gas, that if the state's going to come in and take 49%, then they aren't sure that they want to explore or develop the field, because the same people that are doing that are, in some cases, utilities companies that are looking for a gas supply. So we originally had 100% in there. We reduced it to 49%. We also put in the provision that can be waived on a particular sale. We also put in the provision to tie it to the disposal of royalty, wherein right now the department and the royalty board are supposed to make a decision as to what the in-state demands for royalty oil and gas are. I think it's pretty tightly tied down and probably isn't too objectionable, except that some people look at the 49% figure and say, well, what if that happens to me, and would probably rather see a smaller percentage. I think that personally, I think it's okay. Section Z provides that all the data will be turned over to the state. It will be non-interpretive data, that is, not a company's analysis of what the data means, but raw field data, and that the data would be held confidential. And we're running back through the alphabet again. Section AA. Provides for a continuance of existing non-competitive leases. There's only two more sections of the bill I'm going to say anything about. Section 3 on page 12, starting line 6, puts a maximum of 200,000 acres uplands holding reduction from the present 500,000 by any one company or person. The idea again is to encourage the development of these lands and not holding them in inventory. It gives people 10 years to conform, because there are companies right now that hold over at least 200,000 acres of upland leases, and they're held under the longer term lease provisions than we're contemplating in this bill. As to whether it's necessary to reduce the total holdings that are allowable, if you're going to keep the lease term, particularly if a work commitment provision is included in the leases, it may be an open question. I think it was suggested by Milton Lipton this morning that the total amount of acreage that be held by any one person was sort of irrelevant if they had a limited amount of time. 10 years is almost forever, 5 years is a fairly short time. And if a work commitment were combined with that, a work commitment requirement, not a work commitment bid, that there's no particular reason to limit the amount of land any one company can hold. I think he's got a good argument. That particular argument didn't come up in committee, but it would require other changes in the bill to take the benefit of the argument into account. Section 5, going on down the page, is basically a restatement of the earlier section on the installment plan. They have to put down 20% of the cash that they bid, whether or not it was a bonus bid sale or whether a fixed bonus was called for. They're going to have to put a minimum of 20% down. As you see, it's a revision of the current statute where equal to 20% of the bonus amount bid. Well, we're talking about other mechanisms where the bid may be other than the bonus, maybe other than the front end cash. So we just dropped the last two words to make sure there still was a 20% down payment on the front end money. And come to the last section of the bill, section 6, the department doesn't like this section, neither does, I don't think, the companies do. It's a transitional provision that would allow the legislature, once this law is adopted, to review immediately, starting in 1979, all 5 years of the leasing program and disapprove any part of it, even the leases that might be going to occur in 1979. The reason it was put in there is if you're going to start this review process, you have to start it someplace, and there has been no legislative review of the state leasing program. So as if a matter of policy, you're going to start that. Your first review is going to have to include the leases that are up next year, or going to bid next year, unless you want to exempt them from the law entirely. So that's what the transitional section does. It provides for legislative review and possible veto of the first 3 years of the program. And after that, it'd be on the basis that we talked about earlier on the board. Ms. Chairman, in going through the bill, I've tried to give the policy considerations that came up on each section in the Resources Committee. I probably missed a lot of things because we had, I don't know, at least 15 meetings and must have spent something like 60 to 80 hours on the legislation. Just to summarize, though, the bill as written provides for an ongoing leasing program. It provides for an orderly process, orderly at least in that the process is spelled out, of how lands are selected and how they get to be leased. And it provides legislative review of that leasing program, and it provides flexibility in the actual leasing mechanisms that allow the executive branch to structure the lease, the bids on the leases in a fashion that they believe encourages competition and are also in the best interest of the state and perhaps the lease bidders as well. I think that the legislature should review their leasing law. They should provide for an orderly development program, proper planning, and some sort of certainty to that program. And I think that we also should find some mechanism in addition to the present cash bonus bid system for competitive leasing of state oil and gas lands, because I think that the present system provides, in some cases, or encourages non-economic investment. So I think that in one version or another, the bill should be adopted by the legislature. I'll be glad to participate in any work sessions the committee may hold. Thank you for putting up with me.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Mr. Malone at this point? Okay, I'd like to inquire as to the other persons who would like to testify on the bill. The persons who would like to testify on the bill, raise their hand so we can get some kind of inventory and see if we have to put the thing over for next week. Wiles, okay. If you're it, Gene, would you like to?
Yeah. Is there anybody from the administration here?
My name is Gene Wiles, and I represent Chevron USA Inc. And we had prepared John Carson had prepared written testimony for the hearings before the Resources Committee. And I only have one copy left. And I'll use it and leave it with you. I think that
you would.
I think the resources has other copies that I can get out of copies maybe. But basically, we have we feel that there really is no need for the for the present legislation, we feel that the system that we've had has been operating for a number of years and has been operating well. But in relation to the bill itself, and this statement was prepared before the Resources Committee substitute. But basically, one of the objections that we have is the wide variety of bidding methods to be employed. We feel that this is more or less opening it up to new procedures that have not been tried, and Alaska will be the proving ground for these procedures. I'd just like to list some of the advantages that we feel that that we have for cash bonus bidding. First of all, and I think this is important to the Finance Committee, it does guarantee an income to the state. The question was asked this morning, why do you have bonus biddings and why do you have these bids that other people come in and they say that if the state gets this information that they will be able to evaluate it and maybe put it out on royalty bids or on net profits. But one of the problems that confronts the industry is that we can have the same geological and geophysical information. Each company can have it, and they come up with a different answer. Some will bid on it, some won't, based upon practically the same information. I don't know whether the state is in a better position using this information to make that evaluation or not. And in a situation of bonus bidding or net profits, if you don't have the front money and you have a dry hole, well, the state has lost that money. And I understand the philosophy of Mr. Speaker Malone is that maybe the state shouldn't have that, but we feel that in the industry that there's enough big brotherhood in existence now, and that if we're willing to take this risk on the basis of the information that we have, that that's the risk we'll take. And if we bid millions of dollars and drill a dry hole, we're willing to take that risk. And this is the second one. It removes exploration risk from the state and places it on the industry where it belongs. And I think this is quite important. I would certainly hate to be the Commissioner of Natural Resources or Mr. Easy Gilbreth or whoever it is that has to make the decision as to what type of bidding you're going to use. And I think that, for example, the example that was given was in the Gulf where seven dry holes have been drilled at the expense of about $120 million. And nothing has been recovered. If there was no front money there, I think people would be looking at the person that made that decision with the stance. I'd certainly hate to be in his position. And then your large upfront money, I think, guarantees expiration, because this is money that's there, it's been spent, and in order to recoup your investment, you go out and explore. Either you find something or you don't, but you're not going to sit there and lose the interest on that money. One of the other reasons is that it's one of the simplest methods that you can find. It's very easy to administer. These other methods, your net profits, your bonus, or your royalty bidding would be very difficult to administer. You'd have to have increased staff, more government, more people working. Another thing is that the determination of the winner is obvious. You look at the bid, and there it is. In some of your other situations, I don't know how you're going to come up with a winner. And I'll go into that. And the disadvantage of royalty bidding, it encourages speculation. Someone can come in, I think Mr. Lipton pointed this out, and give a high royalty bid just to get the lease. It places more of an exploration risk on the state. I suppose that someone has to make this decision, whether he's gonna have a royalty or a bonus bid, is gonna have to evaluate the material that's submitted, and maybe even have to do some of their own exploration work, I don't know, to make these determinations. Then, with your sliding scale royalty, this will be difficult to administer also, because you're gonna have to have someone in there determining when the production goes up and down, and it will take increase that. And then your straight royalty bid will result in some instances in a premature abandonment. And I think Mr. Lipton explained that this morning too. You get to the point where you've bid a large royalty and production goes down, you're either gonna be asking for a reduction in the royalty or you're gonna abandon it prematurely. And then again, I think another thing is the administration. Once again, you're gonna get into a very, very complex administrative problem in both the royalty and the net profits. I mean, and then in your net profit sharing bidding, yeah, most of the disadvantages you have in your royalty bidding, very, very difficult to administer. And then a determination of the winning bid is difficult. The state must make a judgment on the operating efficiency of each operator. In other words, when you go into a net profit, if you have an efficient operator, you're gonna have more net profits. If you have an inefficient operator, you're gonna have less net profits. How do you evaluate that when you're looking at a bid? And then judgments must be made about which expenditures are used for calculating the profit base. And here your difficulty is compounded by the differences in accounting procedures between the various companies. Each company has their own accounting procedures. And another, I think, a minus for the net profit sharing is that it removes much of the incentive for efficiency and operations to a certain extent. If you have a net profits, why I think in all those, the operator is going to be a little more efficient. Once again, your bureaucracy to administer it is there. So that's one of the objections we have to that. Speaker Malone suggested that that the bill would probably meet the objective with a cash bonus bidding and a net profits, which may be a work commitment incentive, not a work commitment bid, but a work commitment incentive. We feel very strongly that the royalty bidding not only very disadvantageous to the state, it's also disadvantageous to the company. And we would suggest very strongly that this method be dropped as well. Then the next suggestion is that we had this prepared. We felt that the state's call on production, we have a problem there if we enter into contracts and make commitments. And then we have the state making a call on production. I think you can see what the problem would be. And it would impair any contractual relation you'd have. I guess you'd have to make a contract where the contract would be conditioned on whether or not the state made a call on production, but it would sure make difficult any type of business operation if they were relying on the gas production that we had. Then this one we had short and restrictive lease terms. I think that has been alleviated to a certain extent. In the original bill, it was just a strict 5-year lease. The provisions now provide that it can be extended to 10 years, or 10-year leases can be issued because of climatic conditions and the environment, and I think that's good, because of the nature of the terrain here and the short season, sometimes it takes more than 5 years to even get in there and do your exploration work. We also feel that the submission, the diagram that was put on the board there, and the submission of this plan to the legislature in this manner, really hinders the Commissioner of Natural Resources in the leasing programs. And I think Mr. Lipton also pointed this out this morning, that there can be situations where the federal government or maybe the native corporations put land up for lease, and it becomes imperative that, or at least beneficial, that the state put up their leases, their lands adjacent to up for lease. And if these areas are not included in this five-year plan, there's no way that the commissioner can handle it. There are provisions that Speaker Malone pointed out that would allow some discretion and some exceptions, but I don't think they're broad enough to cover the situation. And now you're going to find out one of the major companies are. We object to the banning of joint meeting by major companies. We feel that this does not fit in with the purpose of the law. The purpose of the law is to obtain as many people bidding as you possibly can. And here, where the costs are so high for drilling wells, even the major companies find it necessary to bid together in order to acquire the capital to do the exploration and drilling work. I also think that it would cut down on the amount of money and the amount of bidders and the amount of money the state would get for their bid. That also applies to the reduced acreage chargeability. I think Speaker Malone covered that too, that if you did have a work incentive in there, that this would not be necessary. And furthermore, I think that I don't know how many companies, I don't have the figures on that, but there are a number of companies up here that are very close to 200,000 acres. And this would, as pointed out by Mr. Lipton, this would preclude those companies from bidding on state leases. And I think Speaker Malone said that there's two companies now that have the 200,000 acres. And I would, if you go on a cash bonus bid, of course, this is going to cut down the cash bonuses that the state would receive for these leases. And it would restrict the number of people that you would have bidding on your lease sales. In addition to that, I'd like to point out one particular section here that I marked, and that's Section J. On page 5, and that is, the commissioner may, in his discretion, defer any part of the payment of a cash bonus under F of this section according to a schedule announced at the time of the announcement of the lease sale. Now, going back and correlating that with C, I don't know whether they're inconsistent or not, on page 12, 5C, the commissioner shall require each bidder for the competitive leasing well and gas to submit his bid, a deposit of money equal to 20% of the bonus. And I think you should look at that and see if it isn't inconsistent, but I would say that this would not fit the purpose of the bill either. I think this would create speculation. Once again, the same as on your relative bid. Someone come in and say, well, I don't have to put all this money up now, I'll just, you know, pay part of it, and maybe he'll hold it to see if he can peddle it. Maybe he won't go out and about, but I think it's more detrimental than it is beneficial, because I do think that it would create speculation.
Isn't this existing one?
That section referred to existing, except for changing the word amount of bids and bonus.
Pardon me?
Isn't that existing law? Kate, you were referring to page 12, section 5.
That is part of the existing law. I was just, the part that isn't existing law is J, and I was wondering if they weren't inconsistent. One says that he may defer any part of the payment, okay? And the other one says that he shall collect 20%. My real purpose of mentioning this, I think, is by allowing this type of installment payments, you're actually making it speculative.
I noticed the Resource Committee suggested, I guess not that portion of it.
We also agree that this section 6 on transitional provisions should be deleted from the bill. In conclusion, I just reiterate that the leasing program that we have has been very successful, and we feel that if there is going to be a bill adopted, that these changes that we suggested should be in the bill.
We would like to have a copy of the statement.
Right.
I must say I'm sorely tempted to engage in a better cross-examination, but it's time to move. Are there questions of Mr. Wiles?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wiles, for appearing here. Are there other persons who would like to? Yes, please.
My name is Ed Phillips. I'm an economist with the Division of Minerals and Energy Management, and I would like to make some brief comments about the economic implications of the various bidding methods expressed in House Bill 854. In so doing, I would like to proceed from the abstract to the understandable, as is the want of most economists, and say that if we start with a world of perfect certainty, that is to say, we know exactly how much oil is in the ground, the cost of getting it out, the cost of production, and the future prices. If all that is known with perfect certainty, then, of course, competition will ensure us that we will get the maximum value for the oil in the ground, because under these conditions, virtually anyone could be eligible for a loan from the banking system, virtually anyone could get a loan to explore and get the oil out. And under these conditions, all the bidding systems would yield exactly identical revenue to the state. The state would be indifferent between bonus bidding and royalty bidding, sliding scale royalty, or any other sort of system, because the most efficient bidder under any of the systems would essentially assure the state of receiving the maximum value. Now, in the real world, of course, we don't have perfect certainty about costs and future prices, all of which is necessary to ensure maximum values. When we allow risk and uncertainty to enter into the world of business, then we find that these different bidding systems will result in different kinds of results to the state. Of the systems, the bonus bid is the only system among the alternatives that in fact will increase the risk as a result of entering the real world. All of the other systems tend to reduce the risk to the firm. This system, bonus bidding per se, happens to increase the risk to firms, thereby reducing the number of potential firms that can, in fact, bid on a given sale. The reason for it increasing the risk is it increases the financial commitment the individual firm has to make to a given sale. And this risk is shared unequally by different firms. Exxon, for example, has a different financial risk than, let's say, Husky Oil. And the bonus bidding system, therefore, is weighted towards the major firms who can value the results of a given lease sale as less of a financial risk on the stability of the firm than the smaller firms can. So the front-end filter problem is the result of the unequal financial burden associated with bonus bidding. Now, straight royalty bidding reduces the financial risk to the firms. It reduces, eliminates the front-end filter, as it's called. Straight royalty bidding does have some problems. It's been alluded to earlier in the discussion, the major problem being that of early shutdown. Now, the issue, though, is how important the early shutdown problem, in fact, is. Unfortunately, there's very little data to support the magnitude of the early shutdown problem. The one study that was contained in Gaffney's 1977 report to the legislature dealt with the study by Rooney, who found that royalty rates between 0% and 50% resulted in a reduction in total production of about 3.6% from fields. Now, that 3.6% is not an exact figure in the sense that that depends, of course, upon the cost conditions and the production conditions associated with a particular field. In order to be more sensitive to individual cost conditions, it's possible to alter the royalty bidding system and include a sliding scale royalty, which varies the royalty rate with the rate of production from the field. Now, you can make the sliding scale royalty sensitive to more conditions than just production. You can include the field pressure and other conditions. The more conditions you add to the sliding scale royalty, the more the sliding scale royalty begins to resemble a net profit system. Now, the net profit system, from the standpoint of minimizing the risk to the private sector, is the most riskless of the alternatives suggested. And in terms of the state wanting to encourage exploration in areas that are very risky, it is my personal opinion that the net profit bidding system has the most attractive features. I find that situations where the risk is extremely high, that the bonus bidding system is not going to protect the state in any way, shape, or form, because the high risk is going to be discounted very heavily by the private firms and result in, in essence, very low bonuses. I've heard testimony in the past dealing with the issue of, well, the state is protected by the bonus system because it gets cash even if no oil is found. Well, if the companies in fact find that their success rate in Alaska is falling over time, one would expect that would be reflected in their bonuses falling over time relative to previous experience. So the bonus bidding system is not long-range protection for the state in terms of guaranteeing the cash in if dry holes become the, if the incidence of dry holes increases. I, therefore, my personal opinion is that in areas that are extremely risky, the profit sharing, the net profit bidding system has many attractive features. One, it reduces the front end filter. It allows a smaller firm to possibly move in. It also shares all of the uncertainties with the firm. And in so sharing the risks, essentially reduces the rate at which the firms have to discount the risks in their bids. It has been stated that there are administrative problems with bonus, with the profit share bidding. True, there are administrative problems and administrative costs, but these should be weighed against the potential benefits that the state may accrue as a result of the system in terms of potentially increased revenues. I myself am not, do not believe that the administrative problems are that difficult, and I am not particularly sure that the definition of what net profits are is as important as has been alluded to. The reason for this is the following. If the state adopts a definition of net profits that in fact is very stringent, that is to say it adopts a definition of net profits that is includes only a gross revenues, let's say, minus field operating costs. as opposed to an alternative definition where it's gross revenues minus field operating costs minus depreciation minus capital allowances, etc. The difference you'll get as a result of the different net profit definitions will be a difference in the magnitude of the bids, not necessarily a difference in the total amount of revenue the state will receive. In other words, the state would receive high bids on a liberal definition and low bids on a stringent definition, but in fact the net revenue to the state would be the same under both definitions. And I say that because I believe the industry is highly competitive. And in fact, competition would assure that fundamentally the state would receive the same amounts of revenue regardless of the precise definition of net profits. So I personally, I do not feel, therefore, that the net profits definition is a very difficult issue. It's certainly more difficult to administer than bonus bidding, but it has potentially much more advantageous features in terms of encouraging exploration in extremely risky areas. I find very little to commend bonus bidding in areas that are geologically very risky, when in fact the bonus bid itself increases the financial risk to the firms going in. All I can see that doing is reducing the number of potential bidders, thereby reducing the number of the potential high bids on the part of the industry. Again, I think where bonus bidding would be attractive in a situation where very little risk is involved, where there's a very high probability of oil being found, if bonus bidding is attractive there, I personally think straight royalty bidding is every bit as attractive. Primarily because straight royalty bidding, rather than getting the money in a lump sum, straight royalty bidding, rather than getting the money in a lump sum, means that the state would receive the payments over the life of the field, rather than all up front. Both bonus bidding and straight royalty bidding have some advantages where there's a great deal of certainty about finding oil and where there's a great deal of certainty about the future prices of oil. And that's not the case. I personally believe that it's better to explore using alternative systems. Those are all the comments I have. Are there any questions?
Of course.
Yes.
Questions, committee? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that was here to testify? Okay. If not, I guess I'll halt the meeting for the day. I'm going to chair. I'm going to have a hard schedule.
Meeting's adjourned. We meet tomorrow.